across from this rooftop to the next. Alicia, blindfolded and with a gag in her mouth, sat in a chair next to him, her wrists bound to its arms. Father Douglas lifted a megaphone. "That's far enough," he said. I could hear him over the heavy wind. "That's debt cord she's tied up with. Do you know what that is?" "Yeah." He held up his other hand. "This is the detonator. As long as it's sending a signal, she's fine. It's a dead man's switch. If I drop it or let it go, the signal stops and the cord goes off. If the receiver gets damaged and stops receiving the signal, the cord goes off. If you start using magic and destroy one of the devices, it goes off."
"That's way better than the electromagnet thing," I muttered to myself. I raised my voice and bellowed.
"So, how do you want to do this?" "Throw them. Disarm the explosives first." "No. The girl stays where she is. Once I'm gone, I'll send the code to disarm the device."
I considered the distance. It was a good 15-foot jump to get from one rooftop to the other. An easy throw.
"Douglas," I shouted, "think about this for a minute. The swords aren't just sharp and shiny, they're symbols. If you take one up for the wrong reasons, you could destroy it. Believe me, I know. The swords are meant for better things than to molder in a dingy basement," he replied. He held up the detonator. "Surrender them now."
I stared at him for a long second. Then I tossed the entire bag over. It landed at his feet with a clatter. He bent down to open it. I steeled myself. This was about to get dicey. I hadn't counted on the dead man switch or a 15-foot-long jump. Father Douglas opened the bag. The smoke grenade Michael had rigged inside it in his workshop went off with a heavy thud. White smoke billowed back into his face. I took 3 quick steps and hurled myself into the air. For an awful portion of a second, 20 stories of open gravity yawned beneath me, and then I hit the edge of the other roof and collided with Father Douglas. We went down together. I couldn't think about anything but the detonator, and I clamped down on that with my left hand, crushing his fingers beneath mine so that he couldn't release it. He jabbed his thumb at my right eye, but I ducked my head and he got nothing but bone. He slammed his head against my nose. Again with the nose. Hell's bells, that hurt. And drove a knee into my groin. I let him, seizing his arm with both hands now, squeezing, trying to choke off the blood to his hand, to weaken it so I could take the detonator from him. His left fist slammed into my temple, my mouth, and my neck. I bent my head down and bit savagely at his wrist, eliciting a scream of pain from him. I slammed my weight against him, slipping some fingers into his grasp, and got one of them over the pressure trigger. Then I wrenched with my whole body, twisting my shoulders and hips for leverage, and ripped the detonator away from him. He rolled away from me instantly and seized the bag. Then he was up and running for a doorway leading down into the building. I let him go and rushed over to Alicia. The dark-haired girl was trembling uncontrollably. Debt cord is basically a long rubber tube filled with explosive compound. It's a little thicker than a pencil, flexible, and generally set off by an electrical charge. Wrap debt cord around a concrete column and set it off, and the explosion will cut through it like a piece of dry bamboo. Alicia was tied to the chair with it. If it went off, it would cut her to pieces. The detonator was a simple setup. A black plastic box hooked to a 12-volt battery, which was in turn connected to a wire leading to the det cord. A green light on the detonator glowed cheerily. It matched a cheery green light on the dead man's switch transmitter in my hand. If what Douglas had said was accurate and the light went out, things wouldn't be nearly so cheery. If I let go of the switch, it would stop the signal to the detonator, which would then complete the circuit, send current to the det cord, and boom. In theory, I should be able to cut the wire leading from the battery and render it harmless, as long as Douglas hadn't rigged the device to detonate if that happened. I didn't have much time. The electronics of the transmitter wouldn't last long around me, even though I hadn't used any magic around them. I had to get the girl out now. I made the call based upon what I knew about Father Douglas. He seemed like he might have good intentions, despite all his shenanigans. So I gambled that he wouldn't want the girl to die, by any means other than a conscious decision from someone, either him letting go of the trigger, or me blowing the transmitter by using magic. I took out my pocket knife, opened it with my teeth, and slashed at the heavy plastic tubing that held her tied down. I cut through the tube once, unwound it from first one arm, then the other, and she was free. She clawed away the blindfold and gag, her fingers still clumsy from being bound. "Come on," I said. I grabbed her arm and hauled her out of the chair and away from the explosives. She staggered, leaning against me, and I ran for the stairs. As we got to the first landing, my ongoing presence apparently became too much for the transmitter. Something sparked and crackled inside the plastic case, the cheery green light went out, and there was a huge and horrible sound from above and behind us. I managed to get between Alicia and the stairwell wall as the pressure wave caught us and threw us into it. It slammed my already abused head into the wall. I staggered under the pain for a minute and forced my way through it, like a drowning man clawing for the surface. "Come on," I croaked to Alicia. "Come on, we have to go." She looked at me with dull, stunned eyes, so I just grabbed her hand and started down the stairs with her, stuffing the heavy transmitter into my duster pocket with the other hand. We had only a few minutes before the place would be swarming with police and firefighters. I didn't particularly feel like answering their questions about why my fingerprints were on an expensive transmitter and showed trace evidence of explosive residue. Going down all those stairs was only slightly less taxing than going up had been, and my legs were going to be complaining at me for days. We got to the bottom, and I led Alicia out into an alley, then out to Monroe. I looked wildly up and down the street. Michael's truck was there, waiting right where it was supposed to be, out in front of the original building. I put my fingers to my lips and let out a shrill whistle. Michael's truck pulled into the street and stopped in front of us. I hurried Alicia forward. The door swung open and Molly leaned out, taking Alicia's hand and pulling her in. I went in right behind her, though it made things awfully cozy in the pickup's cab. "He's loose with the swords," I said. "Did you do it?"
"Did it,"
Molly replied, and promptly handed me a dashboard compass with one of her own golden hairs stuck to it with clear tape. The needle pointed firmly to the east instead of to the north. The grasshopper had set up a basic tracking spell, one of the handier tricks I know. "He's probably moving on foot through the park," I told Michael. "Circle around a lakeshore. Get us in front of him." "Are you all right, baby?" Michael asked. Alicia fumbled for his hand and squeezed it tight. Then she leaned against Molly and started crying. "Hurry," I told Michael. "He's got to know we've bugged the sword somehow. If he finds those hairs Molly tied onto the hilts, we're done." "He won't get away," Michael said with perfect confidence and slammed the accelerator down as we approached an intersection sporting a bright red light. Maybe it was divine intervention or fate or just good driving, but the truck shot through the intersection, missing two other cars by inches, and sailed on forward. The needle on the compass pointed steadily toward the park as we went, but then abruptly began to traverse from one side to the other. I looked up ahead of me and saw a dark form sprinting across the road that separated the park from Lake Michigan.
"There!"
I shouted, pointing.
"There he is!"
Michael pulled over to the side of the road, and I hit the ground before the truck had stopped moving, sprinting after Father Douglas. He was in good shape, covering the ground in long, loping strides. Normally, it wouldn't have been a contest to catch him. I run 3 or 4 days a week to train for situations exactly like this one. Of course, when I practice, I'm not generally concussed, weary, and sporting a recently dislocated shoulder. Douglas was holding his lead as we sprinted down the beach, and I was tiring more rapidly than I should have. So I cheated. I reached into my pocket, drew out the heavy transmitter, and flung it at him as hard as I could. The black plastic device struck him on the back of the head, shattering and sending several heavy batteries flying. Father Douglas staggered and couldn't keep his balance at the pace he was moving. He went down in the sand. I rushed over to him and seized the bag with the swords, only to have him sweep one leg out in a martial arts move, then kick my legs out from beneath me. I went down too. Father Douglas ripped at the bag, but I clung grimly while we fought and kicked at each other, until the bag tore open under the strain and spilled the swords onto the sand. He seized the hilt of Fidelacius, a katana-type sword that was built to look like a simple, heavy walking stick until you drew the blade. I seized Amorakius, scabbard and all, and barely brought the sheathed broadsword up in time to deflect a sweeping slash from Father Douglas. He gained his knees and swung again, and I had all I could do to lift the sheathed sword and fend off the strike. Blow after blow rained down on me, and there was no time to call upon my power, no opportunity to so much as rise to my knees. Until a size 14 work boot hit Father Douglas in the chest and threw him back. Michael stood over me, an aluminum baseball bat in his right hand. He put out his other hand, and I slapped Amorakius into it. He gripped it mid-blade, like some kind of giant crucifix, and with his bat held in a guard position, limped toward Father Douglas. The priest stared at Michael with wide eyes.
"Stay back," he said. "I don't want to hurt you."
"Who says you're able to?" Michael rumbled. "Put down the sword and I'll let you go."
Douglas stared at him with those cold gray eyes.
"I can't do that."
"Then I'll put you down and take the sword anyway. It's over, Rourke. You just don't realize it yet."
Father Douglas wasted no more time on talk, but came at Michael, the katana whirling. Michael batted, no pun intended, the attack aside like a cat swatting down moths, the baseball bat spinning.
"Slow," he said. "Too slow to hit a half-blind cripple. You don't know the first thing about what it means to bear a sword."
Douglas snarled and came at him again. Michael defeated this attack, too, with contemptuous ease, and followed it by smacking Douglas across one cheek with the hilt of the sheathed sword.
"It means sacrifice," Michael said as Douglas reeled. "It means forgetting about yourself and what you want. It means putting your faith in the Lord God Almighty."
He swung a pair of blows, which Douglas defended against, barely. But the third, a straight thrust with the baseball bat's tip, drove home into his solar plexus. Douglas staggered to one knee.
"You abandon your duty," Douglas gasped. "The world grows darker by the day.
People cry out for our help, and you would have the sword sit with this creature of witchcraft and deceit?" "You arrogant child," Michael snarled. "The Almighty himself has made his will known. If you are a man of faith, then you must abide by it."
"You have been lied to," Douglas said. "How could God ignore his people when they need his protection so badly?"
"That is not for us to know," Michael shouted. "Don't you see, you fool? We are only men. We see only in one place at one time. The Lord knows all that might be. Would you presume to say that you know better than our God what should be done with the swords?"
Douglas stared at Michael.
"Are you stupid enough to believe that he would want you to cast aside your beliefs to impose your will upon the world? Do you think he wants you to murder decent men and abduct innocent children?"
The bat struck Philolacius from Douglas's hands, and Michael followed it with a pair of crushing blows, one to the shoulder and one to the knee. Douglas went down to the sand in a heap.
"Look at yourself," Michael said, his words hard and merciless. "Look at what you have done in God's name. Look at the bruises on my daughter's arms, at the blood on my friend's face, and then tell me which of us has been deceived."
Again the bat swept down and Douglas fell senseless to the sand. Michael stood over the man for a moment, his entire body shaking, the bat still upraised.
"Michael," I said quietly.
"He hurt my little girl, Harry."
His voice shook with barely repressed rage. "He isn't going to hurt her now," I said.
"He hurt my little girl."
"Michael," I said gently, "you can't. If this is how it has to be, I'll do it. But you can't, man." His eyes shifted back toward me for just a second.
"Easy, easy," I told him. "We're done here. We're done."
He stared for another long, silent moment. Then he lowered the bat very slowly and bowed his head. He stood there for a minute, his chest heaving, and then dropped the bat. He settled down onto the sand with a wince. I got up and collected Philolacius, returning it to its sheath.
"Thank you," Michael said quietly. He offered me Amorakius's hilt.
"Are you sure?" I asked.
He nodded, smiling wearily.
"Yes."
I took the sword and looked at Douglas.
"What do we do with him?"
Michael stared at him silently for a moment. In the background, we could hear emergency vehicles arriving to attend to the aftermath of the rooftop explosion.
"We'll bring him with us," Michael said. "The church will deal with its own."
I sat in the chapel balcony at St. Mary's, staring down at the church below me and brooding. Michael and Forthill had been seeing to Father Douglas, who wasn't going anywhere under his own locomotion for a while. They had him in a bed somewhere. It had hurt to watch Michael, moving in what was obviously great pain, hobble around the room, helping to make Douglas feel better. I'd have been content to dump the asshole in an alley somewhere and leave him to his fate. Which might just possibly be one reason I was never going to be a knight. I had also swiped Forthill's flask of scotch from his room, and it was keeping me company in the balcony. Two more reasons I was never going to be a knight.
"Right at the end there," I said to no one in particular. "Those two started speaking a different language. I mean, I understood all the words, and I understood the passion behind them, but I don't get how they connect, you know?"
I sipped some more scotch.
"Come to think of it, there are a lot of things I don't get about this whole situation."
"And you want an explanation of some kind?" asked a man seated in the pew beside me. I just about jumped out of my skin. He was an older man. He had dark skin and silver-white hair, and he wore a blue workman's jumpsuit, like you often see on janitors. The name tag read Jake.
"You," I breathed. "You're the archangel. You're Uriel."
He shrugged. The gesture carried acknowledgement, somehow.
"What are you doing here?"
I asked, maybe a bit blearily. I was concussed, and half the flask was gone.
"Perhaps I'm a hallucination brought on by head trauma and alcohol," he said.
"Oh," I said. I peered at him, then offered him the flask. "Want a belt?"
"Very kind," he said, and took a swig from the flask. He passed it back to me. "I don't exactly make it a habit to do this, but if you've got questions, ask them."
"Okay," I said. "Why did you guys let Michael get so screwed up?"
"We didn't let him do anything," Jake replied calmly. "He chose to hazard himself in battle against the enemy. The enemy chose to shoot him, and where to point the gun and when to pull the trigger. He survived the experience."
"So in other words, God was doing nothing to help."
Jake smiled. "Wouldn't say that. But you've got to understand, son. God isn't about making good things happen to you, or bad things happen to you. He's all about you making choices, exercising the gift of free will. God wants you to have good things and a good life, but he won't gift-wrap them for you. You have to choose the actions that lead you to that life."
"Free will, huh?"
"Yes. For example, your free will on that island."
I eyed him and sipped more scotch. "You saw the Valkyrie staring at Michael. You thought he was in danger. So even though it was your turn, you sent him up to the helicopter in your place."
"No good deed goes unpunished," I said, with one too many sh sounds. "That's where he got hurt."
Jake shrugged. "But if you hadn't, you'd have died in that harness, and he'd have died on that island." I scowled.
"What?"
Jake waved a hand. "I won't bore you with details, but suffice to say that your choice in that moment changed everything."
"But you lost a knight," I said. "A warrior."
Jake smiled.
"Did we?"
"He can barely walk without that cane. Sure, he handled Douglas, but that's a far cry from dealing with a Denarian."
"Ah," Jake said. "You mean warrior in the literal sense."
"What other kind of warrior is there?" I asked.
"The important kind."
I frowned again.
"Harry," Jake said, sighing.
"The conflict between light and darkness rages on so many levels that you literally could not understand it all. Not yet, anyway. Sometimes that battlefield is a literal one. Sometimes it's a great deal more nebulous and metaphorical."
"But Michael and I are literal guys," I said.
Jake actually laughed.
"Yeah? Do you think we angled to have you brought into this situation because we needed you to beat someone up?"
"Well, generally speaking, yeah," I gestured with the flask.
Pretty much all we did was beat up this guy who had good intentions and who was desperate to do something to help.
Jake shook his head. The real war happened when you weren't looking.
Huh?
Courtney, Jake said. The little girl who almost got hit by a car.
What about her? I asked.
You saved her life, he said. Moreover, you noted the bruise on her cheek, one she acquired from her abusive father. Your presence heightened her mother's response to the realization that her daughter was being abused. She moved out the next morning. He spread his hands. In that moment, you saved the child's life, prevented her mother from alcohol addiction in response to the loss, and shattered a generational cycle of abuse more than 300 years old.
Chuck the electrician, Jake continued. He was drunk because he'd been fighting with his wife. 2 months from now, their 4-year-old daughter is going to be diagnosed with cancer and require a marrow transplant. Her father is the only viable donor. You saved his life with what you did, and his daughter's life too. And the struggle that family is going to face together is going to leave them stronger and happier than they've ever been. I grunted.
That smells an awful lot like predestination to me. What if those people choose something different?
It's a complex issue, Jake admitted. But think of the course of the future as, flowing water. If you know the lay of the land, you can make a good guess where it's going. Now, someone can always come along and dig a ditch and change that flow of water. But honestly, you'd be shocked how seldom people truly choose to exercise their will within their lives.
I grunted. What about the second base person, Kelly? I saved her life, too?
No, but you made a young woman feel better in a moment where she felt as though she didn't have anyone she could talk to. Just a few kind words. But it's going to make her think about the difference those words made. She's got a good chance of winding up as a counselor to her fellow man. The 5 minutes of kindness you showed her is going to help thousands of others. He spread his hands. And that only takes into account the past day. Despair and pain were averted, loss and tragedy thwarted. Do you think you haven't struck a blow for the light, warrior?
And, last but not least, let's not forget Michael, he said. He's a good man, but where his children are involved, he can be completely irrational. He was a hairbreadth from losing control when he stood over Douglas on the beach. Your words, your presence, your will helped him to choose mercy over vengeance.
I just stared at him for a moment. But I didn't actually mean to do any of that. He smiled.
But you chose the actions that led to it. No one forced you to do it, and to those people, what you did saved them from danger as real as any creature of the night.
He turned to look down at the church below and pursed his lips.
People have far more power than they realize, if they would only choose to use it.
Michael might not be cutting demons with a sword anymore, Harry, but don't think for a second that he isn't still fighting the good fight. It's just harder for you to see the results from down here.
I swigged more scotch, thinking about that.
He's happier now, I said. His family, too.
Funny how making good choices leads to that.
What about Father Douglas? I asked. What's going to happen?
For the most part, Jake said, that will be up to him. Hopefully he'll choose to accept his errors and change his life for the better.
I nodded slowly. Then I said, let's talk about my bill.
Jake's eyebrows shot up.
What?
My bill, I said, enunciating. You dragged me into this mess, you can pay me, same as any other client. Where do I send the invoice?
You're trying to bill the Lord God Almighty? Jake said, as if he couldn't quite believe it.
Heck no, I said. I'm billing you.
That isn't really how we work.
It is if you want to work with me, I told him, thrusting out my jaw. Cough up. Otherwise, maybe next time I'll just stand around whistling when you want me to help you out.
Jake's face broadened into a wide, merry grin, and laughter filled his voice.
No, you won't, he said, and vanished.
I scowled ferociously at the empty space where he'd been a moment before.
Cheapskate, I muttered.
But I was pretty sure he was right.
Last Call, from Strange Brew, edited by P.N. Elrod. Takes place between Small Favor and Turncoat. Having already written a Mead-themed short story, I wasn't quite sure what to do with this one. But hey, it was Pat Elrod asking me, and I've never been good at saying no, and I decided to tread upon what is very nearly holy ground in the Dresden Files. The forces of darkness were going to violate Max Beer. Naturally, Harry gets to respond just as many readers would. Oh, snap! This was a fairly light-hearted piece for me, anyway, and I tried to carry the same sense of energy and pace through the story that you get from the really good Monster of the Week episodes of The X-Files. I'll have to make it up to Mac sometime.
All I wanted was a quiet beer. That isn't too much to ask, is it? One contemplative drink at the end of a hard day of professional wizarding? Maybe a steak sandwich to go with it? You wouldn't think so, but somebody, or maybe somebody, disagreed with me. McAnally's pub is a quiet little hole in the wall, like 100 others in Chicago, in the basement of a large office building. You have to go down a few stairs to get to the door. When you come inside, you're at eye level with the creaky old ceiling fans in the rest of the place, and you have to take a couple of more steps down from the entryway to get to the pub's floor. It's lit mostly by candles. The finish work is all hand-carved, richly polished wood, stained a deeper brown than most would use, and combined with the candles, it feels cozily cave-like. I opened the door to the place and got hit in the face with something I'd never smelled in Mac's pub before. The odor of food being burned. It should say something about Mac's cooking that my first instinct was to make sure the shield bracelet on my left arm was ready to go as I drew the blasting rod from inside my coat. I took careful steps forward into the pub, blasting rod held up and ready. The usual lighting was dimmed, and only a handful of candles still glimmered. The regular crowd at Mac's, members of the supernatural community of Chicago, were strewn about like broken dolls. Half a dozen people lay on the floor, limbs sprawled oddly, as if they dropped unconscious in the middle of calisthenics. A pair of older guys who were always playing chess at a table in the corner lay slumped across the table. Pieces were spread everywhere around them, some of them broken, and the old chess clock they used had been smashed to bits. Three young women who had watched too many episodes of Charmed, and who always showed up at Max together, were unconscious in a pile in the corner, as if they'd been huddled there in terror before they collapsed. But they were splattered with droplets of what looked like blood. I could see several of the fallen breathing, at least. I waited for a long moment, but nothing jumped at me from the darkness, and I felt no sudden desire to start breaking things and then take a nap. Mac? I called quietly. Someone grunted. I hurried over to the bar and found Mac on the floor beside it. He'd been badly beaten. His lips were split and puffy. His nose had been broken. Both his hands were swollen and purple, defensive wounds probably. The baseball bat he kept behind the bar was lying next to him, smeared with blood, probably his own. "Stars and stones," I breathed. "Mac?" I knelt down next to him, examining him for injuries as best I could. I didn't have any formal medical training, but several years' service in the Wardens, in a war with the vampires of the Red Court, had shown me more than my fair share of injuries. I didn't like the look of one of the bruises on his head, and he'd broken several fingers, but I didn't think it was anything he wouldn't recover from. "What happened?" I asked him.
"Went nuts," he slurred.
One of his cut lips reopened and fresh blood appeared.
"Violent."
I winced.
"No kidding."
I grabbed a clean cloth from the stack on the shelf behind the bar and ran cold water over it. I tried to clean some of the mess off his face. "They're all down," I told him as I did. "Alive. It's your place. How do you want to play it?" Even through as much pain as he was in, Mac took a moment to consider before answering.
"Murphy," he said finally.
I'd figured. Calling in the authorities would mean a lot of questions and attention, but it also meant everyone would get medical treatment sooner. Mac tended to put the customer first, but if he'd wanted to keep it under the radar, I would have understood that, too. I'll make the call, I told him. The authorities swooped down on the place with vigor. It was early in the evening, and we were evidently the first customers for the night shift EMTs.
Jesus,
Sergeant Karen Murphy said from the doorway, looking around the interior of Mac's place.
What a mess.
Tell me about it, I said glumly. My stomach was rumbling, and I was thirsty besides, but it just didn't seem right to help myself to any of Mac's stuff while he was busy getting patched up by the ambulance guys. Murphy blew out a breath. Well, brawls in bars aren't exactly uncommon. She came down into the room, removed a flashlight from her jacket pocket, and shone it around. But maybe you'll tell me what really happened. Mac said his customers went nuts. They started acting erratic and then became violent. What, all of them? At the same time? That was the impression he gave me. He wasn't overly coherent. Murphy frowned and slowly paced the room, sweeping the light back and forth methodically. You get a look at the customers? There wasn't anything actively affecting them when I got here, I said. I'm sure of that. They were all unconscious. Minor wounds looked like they were mostly self-inflicted. I think those girls were the ones to beat Mac. Murphy winced.
You think he wouldn't defend himself against them?
He could have pulled a gun. Instead, he had his bat out. He was probably trying to stop someone from doing something stupid, and it went bad.
You know what I'm thinking? Murphy asked. When something odd happens to everyone in the pub?
She had stopped at the back corner. Among the remnants of broken chessmen and scattered chairs, the circle of illumination cast by her flashlight had come to rest on a pair of dark brown beer bottles. Ugly thought, I said. Max beer in the service of darkness. She gave me a level look. Well, as level a look as you can give when you're a 5-foot blonde with a perky nose, glaring at a gangly wizard most of 7 feet tall.
I'm serious, Harry. Could it have been something in the beer? Drugs? A poison? Something from your end of things?
I leaned on the bar and chewed that thought over for a moment. Oh, sure, technically it could have been any of those. A number of drugs could cause psychotic behavior, though admittedly it might be hard to get that reaction in everyone in the bar at more or less the same time. Poisons were just drugs that happened to kill you, or the reverse. And if those people had been poisoned, they might still be in a lot of danger. And once you got the magical side of things, any one of a dozen methods could have been used to get to the people through the beer they'd imbibed. But all of them would require someone with access to the beer to pull it off, and Mac made his own brew. In fact, he bottled it himself.
It wasn't necessarily the beer, I said. You think they all got the same steak sandwich? The same batch of curly fries?
She shook her head. Come on, Dresden. The food here is good, but that isn't what gets them in the door.
Mac wouldn't hurt anybody, I said quietly.
Really? Murph asked, her voice quiet and steady. You're sure about that? How well do you really know the man? I glanced around the bar, slowly. What's his first name, Harry?
Damn it, Murph, I sighed. You can't go around being suspicious of everyone all the time.
Sure I can, she gave me a faint smile. It's my job, Harry. I have to look at things dispassionately. It's nothing personal, you know that.
Yeah, I muttered. I know that, but I also know what it's like to be dispassionately suspected of something you didn't do. It sucks.
She held up her hands. Then let's figure out what did happen. I'll go talk to the principals, see if anyone remembers anything. You take a look at the beer.
Yeah, I said. Okay.
After bottling it, Mac transports his beer in wooden boxes like old apple crates, only more heavy duty. They aren't magical or anything. They're just sturdy as hell, and they stack up neatly. I came through the door of my apartment with a box of samples and braced myself against the impact of Mister, my tomcat, who generally declares a suicide charge on my shins the minute I come through the door. Mister is huge, and most of his mass is muscle. I rocked at the impact, and the bottles rattled, but I took it in stride. Mouse, my big, shaggy dogosaurus, was lying full on his side by the fireplace, napping. He looked up and thumped his tail on the ground once, then went back to sleep. No work ethic around here at all. But then, he hadn't been cheated out of his well-earned beer. I took the box straight down the stepladder to my lab, calling, "Hi, Molly," as I went down. Molly, my apprentice, sat at her little desk working on a pair of potions.
She had maybe 5 square feet of space to work with in my cluttered lab, but she managed to keep the potions clean and neat, and still had room left over for her Latin textbook, her notebook, and a can of Pepsi, the heathen. Molly's hair was kryptonite green today, with silver tips, and she was wearing cut-off jeans and a tight blue T-shirt with a Superman logo on the front. She was a knockout. "Hi, Harry," she said absently. "Outfit's a little cold for March, isn't it?" "If it were, you'd be staring at my chest a lot harder," she said, smirking a little. She glanced up, and it bloomed into a full smile. "Hey, beer!" "You're young and innocent," I said firmly, setting the box down on a shelf. "No beer for you." "You're living in denial," she replied, and rose to pick up a bottle. Of course she did. I told her not to. I watched her carefully. The kid's my apprentice, but she's got a knack for the finer aspects of magic. She'd be in real trouble if she had to blast her way out of a situation. But when it comes to cobweb-fine enchantments, she's a couple of lengths ahead of me and pulling away fast, and I figured this had to be subtle work. She frowned almost the second she touched the bottle. "That's odd." She gave me a questioning look, and I gestured at the box. She ran her fingertips over each bottle in turn. "There's energy there. What is it, Harry?" I had a good idea of what the beer had done to its drinkers, but it just didn't make sense. I wasn't about to tell her that, though. It would be very anti-Obi-Wan of me. "You tell me," I said, smiling slightly. She narrowed her eyes at me and turned back to her potions, muttering over them for a few moments, and then easing them down to a low simmer. She came back to the bottles and opened one, sniffing at it and frowning some more. "No taste testing," I told her. "It isn't pretty." "I wouldn't think so," she replied in the same tone she'd used while working on her Latin. "It's laced with some kind of contagion focus, I think." I nodded. She was talking about magical contagion, not the medical kind. A contagion focus was something that formed a link between a smaller amount of its mass after it had been separated from the main body. A practitioner could use it to send magic into the main body, and by extension into all the smaller foci, even if they weren't in the same physical place. It was sort of like planting a transmitter on someone's car so that you could send a missile at it later. "Can you tell what kind of working it's been set up to support?" I asked her. She frowned. She had a pretty frown. "Give me a minute." "Tick-tock," I said. She waved a hand at me without looking up. I folded my arms and waited. I gave her tests like this one all the time, and there was always a time limit. In my experience, the solutions you need the most badly are always time-critical. I'm trying to train the grasshopper for the real world. Here was one of her first real-world problems, but she didn't have to know that. So long as she thought it was just one more test, she'd tear into it without hesitation. I saw no reason to rattle her confidence. She muttered to herself. She poured some of the beer out into the beaker and held it up to the light from a specially prepared candle. She scrawled power calculations on a notebook, and 20 minutes later she said, "Huh. Tricky, but not tricky enough." "Oh," I said. "No need to be coy, boss," she said. "The contagion looks like a simple compulsion meant to make the victim drink more, but it's really a psychic conduit." I leaned forward. "Seriously?" Molly stared blankly at me for a moment, then she blinked and said, "You didn't know?" I found the compulsion, but it was masking anything else that had been laid on the beer. I picked up the half-empty bottle and shook my head. "I brought it here because you've got a better touch for this kind of thing than I do. It would have taken me hours to puzzle it out. Good work." "But you didn't tell me this was for real." She shook her head dazedly. "Harry, what if I hadn't found it? What if I'd been wrong?" "Don't get ahead of yourself, grasshopper," I said, turning for the stairs. "You still might be wrong." They'd taken Mac to Stroger, and he looked like hell. I had to lie to the nurse to get in to talk to him, flashing my consultant's ID badge and making like I was working with the Chicago cops on the case. "Mac," I said, coming to sit down on the chair next to his bed, "how are you feeling?" He looked at me with the eye that wasn't swollen shut. "Yeah, they said you wouldn't accept any painkillers." He moved his head in a slight nod. I laid out what I'd found. "It was elegant work, Mac. More intricate than anything I've done." His teeth made noise as they ground together. He understood what two complex interwoven enchantments meant as well as I did. A serious player was involved.
"Find him,"
Mac growled, the words slurring a little. "Any idea where I could start?" I asked him. He was quiet for a moment, then shook his head.
"Kane?"
I lifted my eyebrows. "That thug from Night of the Living Bruise? He's been around?" He grunted.
"Last night. Closing."
He closed his eyes.
"Loud mouth."
I stood up and put a hand on his shoulder. "Rest. I'll chat him up." Mac exhaled slowly, maybe unconscious before I'd gotten done speaking. I found Murphy down the hall. "Three of them are awake," she said. "None of them remember anything for several hours before they presumably went to the bar." I grimaced. "I was afraid of that." I told her what I'd learned. "A psychic conduit?" Murphy asked. "What's that?" "It's like any electrical power line," I said, "except it plugs into your mind, and whoever is on the other end gets to decide what goes in." Murphy went a little pale. She'd been on the receiving end of a couple of different kinds of psychic assault, and it had left some marks. "So do what you do. Put the whammy on them, and let's track them down." I grimaced and shook my head. "I don't dare," I told her. "All I've got to track with is the beer itself. If I try to use it in a spell, it'll open me up to the conduit. It'll be as if I drank the stuff." Murphy folded her arms. "And if that happens, you won't remember anything you learn anyway." "Like I said," I told her, "it's high-quality work. But I've got a name. A perp? I'm sure he's guilty of something. His name's Kane. He's a con. Big, dumb, violent, and thinks he's a brewer." She arched an eyebrow. "You got a history with this guy?" "Ran over him during a case maybe a year ago," I said. "It got ugly. More for him than me. He doesn't like Mac much." "He's a wizard?" "Hell's bells, no," I said. "Then how does he figure in?" "Let's ask him." Murphy made short work of running down an address for Herbert Orson Kane, mugger, rapist, and extortionist, a cheap apartment building on the south end of Bucktown. Murphy knocked at the door, but we didn't get an answer. "It's a good thing he's a con," she said, reaching for her cell phone. "I can probably get a warrant without too much trouble." "With what?" I asked her. "Suggestive evidence of the use of black magic?" "Tampering with drinks at a bar doesn't require the use of magic," Murphy said. "He's a rapist, and he isn't part of the outfit, so he doesn't have an expensive lawyer to raise a stink." "How's about we save the good people of Chicago time and money and just take a look around?" "Breaking and entering." "I won't break anything," I promised. "I'll do all the entering, too." "No," she said. "But," she looked up at me, her jaw set stubbornly, "no, Harry." I sighed. "These guys aren't playing by the rules." "We don't know he's involved yet. I'm not cutting corners for someone who might not even be connected." I was partway into a snarky reply when Kane opened the door from the stairwell and entered the hallway. He spotted us and froze. Then he turned and started walking away. "Kane," Murphy called. "Chicago PD!" He bolted. Murph and I had both been expecting that, evidently. We both rushed him. He slammed the door open, but I'd been waiting for that, too. I sent out a burst of my will, drawing my right hand in toward my chest as I shouted, "Forzare!" Invisible force slammed the door shut as Kane began to go through it. It hit him hard enough to bounce him all the way back across the hall into the wall opposite. Murphy had better acceleration than I did. She caught up with Kane in time for him to swing one paw at her in a looping punch. I almost felt sorry for the slob. Murphy ducked the punch, then came up with all of her weight and the muscle of her legs and body behind her response. She struck the tip of his chin with the heel of her hand, snapping his face straight up. Kane was brawny, big, and tough. He came back from the blow with a dazed snarl and swatted at Murphy again. Murph caught his arm, tugged him a little one way, a little the other, and using his own arm as a fulcrum, sent him flipping forward and down hard onto the floor. He landed hard enough to make the floorboards shake, and Murphy promptly shifted her weight, twisting one hand into a painful angle, holding his arm out straight, using her leg to pin it into position. "That would be assault," Murphy said in a sweet voice. "And on a police officer in the course of an investigation, no less."
"Bitch," Kane said. "I'm gonna break your..."
We didn't get to find out what he was going to break because Murphy shifted her body weight maybe a couple of inches, and he screamed instead.
"What do you want?"
Kane demanded.
"Let me go! I didn't do nothing!"
"Sure you did," I said cheerfully. "You assaulted Sergeant Murphy here. I saw it with my own eyes." "You're a two-time loser, Kane," Murphy said. "This will make it number three. By the time you get out, the first thing you'll need to buy will be a new set of teeth." Kane said a lot of impolite words. "Wow," I said, coming to stand over him. "That sucks. If only there was some way he could be of help to the community. You know, prove how he isn't a waste of space some other person could be using."
"Screw you," Kane said. "I ain't helping you with nothing."
Murphy leaned into his arm a little again to shut him up. "What happened to the beer at McAnally's?" she asked in a polite tone. Kane said even more impolite words. "I'm pretty sure that wasn't it," Murphy said. "I'm pretty sure you can do better."
"Bite me, cop bitch," Kane muttered.
"Sergeant bitch," Murphy said. "Have it your way, bonehead. Bet you've got all kinds of fans back at Stateville." But she was frowning when she said it. Thugs like Kane rolled over when they were facing hard time. They didn't risk losing the rest of their adult lives out of simple contrariness, unless they were terrified of the alternative. Someone, or dare I say it, something, had Kane scared. Well, that table could seat more than one player. The thug had a little blood coming from the corner of his mouth. He must have bitten his tongue when Murphy hit him. I pulled a white handkerchief out of my pocket and, in a single swooping motion, stooped down and smeared some blood from Kane's mouth onto it.
"What the hell?"
he said, or something close to it. "What are you doing?"
"Don't worry about it, Kane," I told him. "It isn't going to be a long-term problem for you."
I took the cloth and walked a few feet away. Then I hunkered down and used a piece of chalk from another pocket to draw a circle around me on the floor. Kane struggled feebly against Murphy, but she put him down again.
"Sit still," she snapped. "I'll pull your shoulder right out of its socket."
"Feel free," I told Murphy. "He isn't going to be around long enough to worry about it." I squinted up at Kane and said, "Beefy, little bit of gut. Bet you eat a lot of greasy food, huh, Kane?"
What? He said. "What are you doing?"
"Heart attack should look pretty natural," I said. "Murphy, get ready to back off once he starts thrashing." I closed the circle and let it sparkle a little as I did. It was a waste of energy. Special effects like that almost always are. But it made an impression on Kane.
"Jesus Christ," Kane said. "Wait!"
"Can't wait," I told him. "Gotta make this go before the blood dries out. Quit being such a baby, Kane. She gave you a chance." I raised my hand over the fresh blood on the cloth. "Let's see now."
"I can't talk," Kane yelped. "If I talk, she'll know."
Murphy gave his arm a little twist.
"Who?"
she demanded.
"I can't! Jesus, I swear! Dresden, don't! It isn't my fault. They needed bloodstone, and I had the only stuff in town that was pure enough. I just wanted to wipe that smile off that bastard's face."
I looked up at Kane with a gimlet eye, my teeth bared. "You ain't saying anything that makes me want you to keep on breathing."
I can't, Kane wailed. "She'll know!"
I fixed my stare on Kane and raised my hand in a slow, heavily overdramatized gesture.
"Intimidatus, storcus maximus,"
I intoned, making my voice intentionally hollow and harsh and stressing the long vowels.
"Decker!" Kane screamed. "Decker! He set up the deal!"
I lowered my hand and let my head rock back. "Decker," I said. "That twit." Murphy watched me and didn't let go of Kane, though I could tell she didn't want to keep holding him. I shook my head at Murphy and said, "Let him scamper, Murph." She let him go, and Kane fled for the stairs on his hands and knees, sobbing. He staggered out, falling down the first flight from the sound of it. I wrinkled up my nose as the smell of urine hit me. Ah, the aroma of truth. Murphy rubbed her hands on her jeans as if trying to wipe off something greasy. Jesus, Harry. What? I said. You didn't want to break into his place.
I didn't want you to put a gun to his head either, she shook her head. You couldn't really have...
Killed him? I asked. I broke the circle and rose. Yeah, with him right here in sight, yeah. I probably could have. She shivered.
Jesus Christ.
I wouldn't, I said. I went to her and put a hand on her arm. I wouldn't, Karen. You know that. She looked up at me, her expression impossible to read.
You put on a really good act, Harry. It would have fooled a lot of people. It looked...
Natural on me, I said. Yeah. She touched my hand briefly with hers.
So I guess we got something?
I shook off dark thoughts and nodded. We've got a name. Bert Decker ran what was arguably the sleaziest of the half-dozen establishments that catered to the magical crowd in Chicago. Left Hand Goods prided itself on providing props and ingredients to the black magic crowd. Oh, that wasn't so sinister as it sounded. Most of the trendy self-appointed Death Eater wannabes in Chicago, or any other city for that matter, didn't have enough talent to strike two rocks together and make sparks, much less hurt anybody. The really dangerous black wizards don't shop at places like Left Hand Goods. You could get everything you needed for most black magic at the freaking grocery store. But all the same, plenty of losers with bad intentions thought Left Hand Goods had everything you needed to create your own evil empire, and Bert Decker was happy to make them pay for their illusions. Me and Murphy stepped in, between a display of socially maladjusted fungi on our right, a tank of newts, pluck your own effing eyes, the sign said, on the left, and stepped around the big shelf of quasi-legal drug paraphernalia in front of us. Decker was a shriveled little toad of a man. He wasn't overweight, but his skin looked too loose from a plump youth combined with a lifetime of too many naps in tanning beds. He was immaculately groomed, and his hair was a gorgeous black, streaked with a dignified silver that was like a Rolls hood ornament on a VW rabbit. He had beady black eyes with nothing warm behind them, and when he saw me, he licked his lips nervously. "Hiya, Bert," I said. There were a few shoppers, none of whom looked terribly appealing. Murphy held up her badge so everyone could see it and said, "We have some questions." She might as well have shouted, "Fire!" The store emptied. Murphy swaggered past a rack of discount porn DVDs, her coat open just enough to reveal the shoulder holster she wore. She picked one up, gave it a look, and tossed it on the floor.
"Christ, I hate scum vendors like this."
"Hey," Bert said, "you break it, you bought it."
"Yeah, right," Murphy said. I showed him my teeth as I walked up and leaned both my arms on the counter he stood behind. It crowded into his personal space. His cologne was thick enough to stop bullets. "Bert," I said, "make this simple, okay? Tell me everything you know about Kane." Decker's eyes went flat, and his entire body became perfectly still. It was reptilian.
"Kane?"
I smiled wider. "Big guy, shaggy hair, kind of a slob, with piss running down his leg. He made a deal with a woman for some bloodstone, and you helped." Murphy had paused at a display of what appeared to be small, smoky quartz geodes. The crystals were nearly black, with purple veins running through them, and they were priced a couple of $100 too high.
"I don't talk about my customers," Decker said. "It isn't good for business."
I glanced at Murphy. "Bert, we know you're connected." She stared at me for a second and sighed. Then she knocked a geode off the shelf. It shattered on the floor. Decker winced and started to protest, but the words died on his lips. "You know what isn't good for business, Decker?" I asked. "Having a big guy in a gray cloak hang out in your little bad juju mart. Your customers start thinking that the council is paying attention. How much business do you think you'll get?" Decker stared at me with toad eyes, nothing on his face. "Oops," Murphy said, and knocked another geode to the floor. "People are in the hospital, Bert," I said. "Max, one of them. And he was beaten on ground held neutral by the Unseelie Accords." Bert bared his teeth. It was a gesture of surprise. "Yeah," I said. I drew my blasting rod out of my coat and slipped enough of my will into it to make the runes and sigils carved along its length glitter with faint orange light. The smell of wood smoke curled up from it.
You don't want the heat this is going to bring down, Bert.
Murphy knocked another geode down and said, I'm the good cop.
All right, Bert said. Jesus, will you lay off? I'll talk, but you ain't gonna like it.
I don't handle disappointment well, Bert.
I tapped the glowing ember tip of the blasting rod down on his countertop for emphasis.
I really don't.
Bert grimaced at the black spots it left on the countertop.
Skirt comes in asking for bloodstone, but all I got is this crap from South Asscrack. Says she wants the real deal, and she's a bitch about it. I tell her I sold the end of my last shipment to Kane.
Woman pisses you off, Murphy said, and you send her to do business with a convicted rapist.
Bert looked at her with toad eyes. How'd you know where to find Kane? I asked.
He's got a discount card here, filled out an application.
I glanced from the porn to the drug gear. Uh-huh. What's he doing with Bloodstone?
Why should I give a crap? Bert said. It's just business.
How'd she pay?
Why do I look like a fucking video camera?
You look like an accomplice to black magic, Bert, I said.
Crap, Bert said, smiling slightly. I haven't had my hands on anything. I haven't done anything. You can't prove anything.
Murphy stared hard at Decker. Then, quite deliberately, she walked out of the store. I gave him my sunniest smile.
That's the upside of working with the gray cloaks now, Bert, I said. I don't need proof. I just need an excuse.
Bert stared hard at me, then he swallowed, toad-like.
She paid with a Visa, I told Murphy when I came out of the store. Met a Trina Bassarid.
Murphy frowned up at my troubled expression.
What's wrong? You ever see me pay with a credit card?
No, I figured no credit company would have you.
Come on, Murph, I said. That's just un-American. I don't bother with the things because the magnetic strip goes bad in a couple of hours around me.
She frowned.
Like everything electronic does. So?
So, if Ms. Bassarid has Kane scared out of his mind on magic, I said.
Murphy got it.
Why is she using a credit card?
Because she probably isn't human, I said. Non-humans can sling power all over the place and not screw up anything if they don't want to. It also explains why she got sent to Kane to get taught a lesson and wound up scaring him to death instead.
Murphy said an impolite word.
But if she's got a credit card, she's in the system.
To some degree, I said. How long for you to find something?
She shrugged.
We'll see. You get a description?
Blue-black hair, green eyes, long legs, and great tits, I said.
She eyed me.
Quoting, I said righteously.
I'm sure she was fighting off a smile.
What are you going to do?
Go back to Max, I said. He loaned me his key.
Murphy looked sideways at me.
Did he know he was doing that?
I put my hand to my chest as if wounded.
Murphy, I said. He's a friend.
I lit a bunch of candles with a mutter and a wave of my hand, and I stared around Max's place. Out in the dining area, chaos reigned. Chairs were overturned. Salt from a broken shaker had spread over the floor. None of the chairs were broken, but the framed sign that read, Accorded Neutral Territory, was smashed and lay on the ground near the door. An interesting detail, that. Behind the bar, where Mac kept his iceboxes and his wood-burning stove, everything was as tidy as a surgical theater, with the exception of the unclean stove and some dishes in the sink. Nothing looked like a clue. I shook my head and went to the sink. I stared at the dishes. I turned and stared at the empty storage cabinets under the bar, where a couple of boxes of beer still waited. I opened the icebox and stared at the food, and my stomach rumbled. There were some cold cuts. I made a sandwich and stood there munching it, looking around the place and thinking. I didn't think of anything productive. I washed the dishes in the sink, scowling and thinking up a veritable thunderstorm. I didn't get much farther than a light sprinkle, though, before a thought struck me. There really wasn't very much beer under the bar. I finished the dishes, pondering that. Had there been a ton earlier? No. I'd picked up the half-used box and taken it home. The other two boxes were where I'd left them, but Mac usually keeps a legion of beer bottles down there. So why only two now? I walked down to the far end of the counter, a nagging thought dancing around the back of my mind where I couldn't see it.
Mac kept a small office in the back corner, consisting of a table for his desk, a wooden chair, and a couple of filing cabinets. His food service and liquor permits were on display on the wall above it. I sat down at the desk and opened the filing cabinets.